Hi, I'm still John. And I have the privilege of actually introducing the important John that's here today. But I do digress. I am a storyteller. John, Mary Burns, his lovely wife, and I have been friends for decades, almost back to biblical time. As young adults, we grew up in the Mercer community. We developed our direction and our purpose and our mission in life. How can we fall in love with the world and see it as holy? And what is at risk if we don't invest places with spirit, with reverence, with holiness? John is the author of 9 books and contributed to a whole bunch of other books as well, all that focus on the natural history of the Wisconsin Northwoods. He's worked as a naturalist in Wisconsin's Northwoods for over 3 decades, leading countless excursions and trips designed to help people further understand the remarkable diversity, beauty, and mystique of our nature and our place within it. John's most recent nonfiction book is Our Living Ancestors, The History and Ecology of Our Old Growth Forest in Wisconsin, and Where to Find Them. And ironically, I stopped at John and Mary's place here, gosh, I don't know when it was, early December, late November. I said, John, I gotta get a copy of this book for Julie as a Christmas gift. And I got it for her, wrapped it, gave it to her, and at Christmas Day, opened it up, started reading it, and she can't have the book till I'm done reading it. It is such a good book. She's read 3 other books already, still waiting to get a hold of this. I'm a slow reader. But at any rate, I did want to read one little spot in here, which I thought I marked. Yes, John is a really good writer. All of us at some point seek clarity, depth, vision, grace, and overarching wisdom that puts life in a perspective that can be encompassed in one horizon line. An old tree, an old forest, a wild place does not automatically provide the vision, but it permits us to think that it is possible and to bid it come. And with that, I bid John to come.
This is great. It's such a lovely place. I'm really honored to be here. David, thank you so much for inviting me. Any excuse to come up to the Big Lake is a really good excuse as far as we're concerned. We always are amazed at how few times we come up here. We live down in the Mercer Manitowish area. It's all of 60 miles away, but sometimes it seems like a long ways. And we live in a beautiful place, too, and tend to just stay home a whole lot. But it's so great to come up to the Big Lake. I was raised in Pennsylvania, and when I was in 7th grade, my parents took me to a Unitarian church on the other side of town, a whole hour drive away, and that was my first exposure to the UU church. We only went for a year or two. It was just too long a drive, 2 hours just in the drive back and forth was too much for my dad, but I was exposed to social justice principles in 7th grade, which I had never heard of up until that point, and I still remember that very distinctly. Of all the quote-unquote religious education I received, that was by far and away the best in my youth. So I'm here to talk about the spirit of place, and the question of what the spirit of place really means came up to me when leading a hike once in an old-growth forest quite a number of years ago, and someone had the temerity to ask, why should we care about old trees? Basically a so-what question, you know, they're old, who cares, kind of thing. And I really stammered and stuttered and tried to articulate why, and you know, there was some science that I put out there, but really it was about the spirit of being in that old tree habitat with trees that were centuries old. So anyway, I wrote a response to it over a while, and actually John read a little piece of that, but I'm going to read you a little bit more of it if you don't mind, because it basically gets to the spirit of place, at least of old growth. Old growth forests take histories that are lodged in the imagination and bring them to life. Here, the ancient people, culture, animal, and plant communities are brought down to earth to where our imaginings can gain a foothold. if a 2,500-year-old California redwood was alive that long ago, so it's possible that Alexander the Great once lived, that Christ, that Muhammad, that Socrates all once had flesh and bone, that Wisconsin hemlock or white pine, now 500 years old, still stands, takes Michelangelo from the shadows, brings Copernicus and Leonardo da Vinci to life, and makes possible whole intact cultures of American Indians. Old growth takes yellowed words on fragile pages and embodies them with real blood seen through green leaves. These old trees were alive back then, they're alive now, and they may live long into the future. They provide the rope that ties time together. They're not fossils, not hardened amber, not footprints, not stories and histories imbued with human biases and imperfection, but living tissue, the keepers of what has come before, the archives, the arboreal Smithsonian. In human life, so fragile and impermanent, we look for connections, bridges from then to now to what will become, and nothing but old growth lives long enough to provide this crossing. Old growth offers a time and scale perspective that's impossible to achieve in the short lives that we humans are given. So since then, there's a whole bunch more in there, but forget all that. A lot of fiddle faddle. Anyway, so since then, I've wondered about the spirit of all places, and all of you live here, right, because of the spirit of this place. If any of you came here to get rich, you were delusional, right? And anybody who came to where we live was delusional if that's what they wanted, was riches. We came here for the riches of the big lake, right? Or in our case, the little lakes where we live, and the beautiful forest, state forest, and national forest. We came for those things, and we stay for those things, right? So I've come up with this anyway about spirit of places, so I'm going to just jump in here. A place is a space with a story, right? And it's not just one story, it's thousands and thousands of individual stories all woven together into a sprawling novel. And the novel ultimately is this character, the persona, the grace, the spirit of the place, whatever that place may be. And like any novel, it has settings and it has storylines and characters and plot twists and conflicts and resolutions, battles, losses, redemptions, all the cool stuff that you find in any great, big, sprawling novel. And thus, the spirit of place is a human construct, right? It's the story inside our head that we tell about any given place. But it's also a physical reality. It's this enormous community of life, these thousands of plant species and bird species, amphibians, and all the things that make up any ecosystem, any place that we're a part of. So all places have a community of life outside of our human life, and thus all, in my mind anyway, have a spirit, an essence, a unique character, a unique personality, and all the stories associated with those things. And to recognize that spirit, I think, involves having two things. You have to have the inner landscape, the open heart, and that deep connection with that outer landscape. So you have to have this in order to see that. So it's a literacy of the heart that's required, and it's an ecological literacy as well. When I wrote a description for this talk, I posed four questions, and I'm just going to kind of buzz through those four. What happens when we first enter a place? What makes one place feel remarkable, even sacred, while another one may elicit little feeling? How can we fall in love with the world and see it as holy? And what's at risk if we don't invest places with spirit and with reverence and with holiness? My notes out here, I could actually do this. All right, so our sense of spirit of a place occurs initially through a whole series of perceptions, right? So we do an immediate, you come to a site and you do an immediate mapping of the major physical features. Then you start pulling out historical and some cognitive information, the name of this tree, the style of architecture that may be there, the function of the place, who was here before us, what were they doing, that kind of stuff. Then you start pulling out personal memories, if you have any. This was the place I got my first kiss. Wow, you know. Or where I used to pick berries with my mom. Or the first swim along a shoreline, a particular shoreline on Lake Superior, where you froze to death, that kind of thing. And then you catalog sensory information. You catalog the sounds and the smells and the light and the birds. And whatever your intentions are that you came with, that's what you will see. Of course, that's your search vision. And then you start to intuit emotional information. So does the place excite you? Does it frighten you? Does it depress you in some manner? Inspire you, bore you, fill you with energy? But you begin to to interact with it emotionally. And finally, you actually begin experientially interacting with it. And you start building a relationship. And this is through your set of filters, whatever those are, your intentions. Intentions are so important. What did you come to this place for? And it's essential to build this relationship over time. Otherwise, it's kind of like a one-night stand. You know, Wallace Stegner said, a place is made a place only by slow accrual, like a coral reef. So it's really important that we take time, lots of time, and lots of us have gray hair here, so we've taken lots of time to try to know the places where we are. And hopefully they become deep in our heart. Second question is, what makes one place feel remarkable, even sacred, while other places may elicit little feeling? So some places at first glance appear more sacred than others based on their external characteristics. Lake Superior, right? So it's a power to trigger awe. So it could be the Grand Canyon, Niagara Falls, the Rockies, Redwoods, whatever. Some places have prominent landmarks, human or natural. So going to Ireland to go see the Standing Stones, you know, Machu Picchu, these kinds of places, Castle Rock in the southern part of the state, big rock formation. Some places have unusual aesthetic characteristics that just awe you as such. Natural sounds, the roar of a waterfall or wind in a canyon or echoing off of canyon walls, the effect of light in a place, the red rocks in Arizona come to mind. Some places are just dangerous, dramatic places, volcanic sites, huge waves on the Pacific Ocean. And some places are between places, caves and shorelines and cliffs and oases and these kind of places that differentiate between two very different things. But I think that, you know, that's easy. That's a lazy form of spiritual connection. It's kind of like charismatic megafauna. You know, John's a wildlife manager. Everybody wants to talk about bears and eagles and ospreys, but who wants to talk about sparrows, you know, and mosses and little brown birds and all that? It's very easy to be excited and awe and feel a spiritual connection to these large things. Easy to fall in love with those. But I think it takes a far more open heart and mind to fall in love with the small stuff and ultimately with everything. And when I think of one book that really gets to that, Robin Wall Kimmerer's first book, Gathering Moss. Has anybody ever read that book? If you want, you know, you'll fall in love with moss, which is really hard to consider, but that book is so fabulous, 150 pages of beautiful writing about the beauty of mosses and what they do. So she's someone who looks small and sees the beauty in all things. So again, the story we tell about a place is inside our head, right? Third question is, how can we fall in love with the world and see it as holy? So I came up with three aphorisms, and I don't know if they're actual real aphorisms, but I'm making them into aphorisms. And the first one is, no one ever washed a rental car. Which I really like that. No one ever washed a rental car. Has anyone here ever washed a rental car? Out of curiosity. You know? So this speaks to ownership of where we are, right? Ownership not in the sense of a title ownership, but in the sense of belonging to a place, and in the sense of being a card-carrying member of a community. It's a need to come home and to be at home in a place. Wendell Berry has a wonderful quote. He says, the world cannot be discovered by a journey of miles, no matter how long, but only by a spiritual journey, a journey of one inch, very arduous and humbling and joyful, by which we arrive at the ground at our feet and learn to be at home. Scott Russell Sanders, another wonderful author out of Indiana, has one of the best paragraphs ever written about home and what it means to actually be at home in a place. And he writes, the shell of a house gives only shelter. A home gives sanctuary. Real estate ads offer houses for sale, not homes. A house is a garment easily put off or on, casually bought and sold. A home is a skin. Merely change houses and you will be disoriented. Change homes and you bleed. When the shell you live in has taken on the savor of your love, when your dwelling has become a taproot, then your house is a home. Isn't that beautiful? I just love that. When I think about ancient people relative to home compared to us moderns, they experienced the land at a really slow walking speed every day, every minute, right? They had stories associated with just about everything because everything was important. Native Americans up here used 384 species of plants just to make their lives go, to work every day. And so every hill and every spring and every rock outcrop and river bend and lake and unusual tree stored memories for people. They belonged to those places. There was no renting going on for them of that rental car. They owned that place in the sense of belonging. And those places held and released memories over a long period of time and over generations. And so I think we too, when we try to see things as holy, we need to just simply go slower and to find the stories in everything. We were all told as kids to quit poking around, right? And I think just the opposite now, as we're old, we need to poke around as much as is humanly possible, just keep poking around and going slow. And in that slowing things down, your footsteps become softer, your mind becomes quieter, your breathing slows down, your reverence awakens within you. And now you're in the presence, once you've slowed down enough, of lives that were once led and are now being led now, that are in a very, and were in a very deep connection with a place. So it's just continually finding aspects of a place to cherish by that deeper connection over time that grows our understanding of the spirit of a place. A lot of that has to do with intention. What's the difference between a walk and a pilgrimage? It's your intention, right? If all you want to do is get the dog out, which we often do, just for a little walk, it's not a pilgrimage. But if you go out with prayerful intent to achieve something more deeply, that walk becomes something very different. If you walk in a labyrinth, you can either have that be a prayerful exercise or you can get dizzy walking in circles. It's your choice, right? So it's also the quality of your presence in beyond your intention is, you know, that being here now thing. Mary and I just led a bird trip to Arizona, and I love birding because you're so focused on hearing and seeing birds, and everything else just kind of disappears out there. You're just birds. You know, there's a trade-off because you're not seeing plants, and you're not seeing rocks, and you're not seeing all kinds of stuff. But you focus intently, and you're totally engaged and in that place at that time. A second aphorism on how we fall in love with the world and see it as holy is to put yourself in the way of grace. I love that, and that's a saying that's used in lots of spiritual paths. Put yourself in the way of grace. Liberty Hyde Bailey, a naturalist from the early 1900s, wrote, "The happiest life has the greatest number of points of contact with the world, and it has the deepest feeling and sympathy for everything that is." So you put yourself in the way of all of that contact, that possible contact. Emerson wrote, "The invariable mark of wisdom is to see the miraculous in the common." So how do you do that every day? In your simple walks or whatever you may be up to, how do you see the miraculous in the common? And one of the things on our birding trip that I found so interesting is we were seeing vermilion flycatchers. I don't know if anybody's familiar with vermilion flycatchers. Brilliant red birds with some black on them. And the first time you see them, you're doing, "Oh, wow, cool. I've got the binoculars up and everybody's getting around the scope and all that stuff." And then we saw like dozens. And pretty soon we didn't raise the binoculars again. Vermilion flycatcher, let's look at something else kind of thing. And so it's interesting how easy it is for we human beings to become accustomed to extraordinarily beautiful things and find them ultimately somewhat routine and not give them a second look. We were very guilty of that on our trip with vermilion flycatchers. So how do we hold on to the awe that we felt at first? And that's difficult. And I think it's done by looking ever closer, looking at those mosses like Robin Wall Kimmerer does, approach with varied intentions, right? But always, the largest intention is always to fall more in love with the place that you're in. The third aphorism in large quotes is live a life of gratitude. And we need gratitude every moment, every place we're in. Peter Steinhardt had a quote where he said, "What we see in lakes or wherever depends on much on what we bring to the shore. King Arthur's sword or the Loch Ness Monster." Right? So if you bring gratitude to the shore of the lake, what will you see? Versus if you bring fear or distraction or whatever else you might bring. Robin Wall Kimmerer takes it a step further in her phenomenal book, Braiding Sweetgrass, which we've read some of on the way up out loud, which we do a lot these days. She says, "Cultures of gratitude must also be cultures of reciprocity. Just as all beings have a duty to me, I have a duty to them. If an animal gives its life to feed me, I am in turn bound to support its life. If I receive a stream's gift of pure water, I'm responsible for returning the gift in kind." So living a life of gratitude has as a responsibility associated with it, somehow finding a way to reciprocate. Fourth question I asked in the thought I would try to address in the description of this talk is, what's at risk if we don't invest places with spirit and with reverence and with holiness, however you want to define those things, right? Well, everything's at risk, right? The major conundrum in loving places is that we have to take from them. We have to utilize trees. We have to utilize land to grow food. We're takers, and there's 7 billion of us taking. I wrote a poem about that, so I'm going to read you a couple poems, and if anybody falls asleep, I don't blame you, but you know, hang in there. This poem's called Cold to the Bone, and it talks about this conundrum of being human beings and taking. Through the mist and buffeting wind, the long-billed curlews beat their way up and down the meanders, at times hard against the wind's pulse, at times careening with it, either way fighting for control, then landing with a grace that says, while there is always struggle, we were made in the same house as the wind. The grebe diving midstream, the mallard sheltering in the shoreline sedges, the rail pacing the thatched bank, the sandpipers probing the muck, each finds its way through this day, each just as likely to be resting with its bill tucked into its feathers as to be a meal for a peregrine, which flashes by us in a laser line, streaming into the swallowing gray. Slow afoot, mist in our eyes, cold to the bone, we delight in every moment among them, as we also delight to depart back to roofs, windows, heat, and a box lunch with food from other soils and waters and winds that once, too, provided a home to wildness, but were traded at a cost. What other trade could we have done? What else can we do? Slow-footed, mist in our eyes, cold to the bone. Jack Turner, I can't remember the title of his book, but he has a great quote in there. He says, without the experience of qualities such as wildness, magic, spirit, and the sacred, we treat flora and fauna as resources and playgrounds. It reminds me of the get all the gusto kind of approach to life. We need to find wildness and magic and spirit and the sacred to see things beyond just resources. And Leopold has a wonderful quote, a very simple one. He's got a gazillion great quotes, but this one always sticks with me. We only grieve for what we know. We only grieve for what we know. So that's that ecological literacy. But to know things, you have to invest your heart. So it's also that heart literacy. So what's at stake if we don't invest places with spirit? Well, you're doomed to hear another poem. And this poem was in response to climate change, right? And reading an article projecting the loss of millions of species due to climate change. Just an overwhelming prospect, right? Many ghosts already roam this land. The passenger pigeon, the Carolina parakeet, the heath hen. Some species are ghosts in waiting, alive but already splintered into ragtag remnants hiding along the edge, hanging on in tiny encampments. Wrote Rainer Maria Rilke, quote, perhaps we are only here for saying house, bridge, fountain, gate, but to say them, oh, to say them more intensely than the things themselves ever dreamed of being, unquote. In Europe, I could say azure-winged magpie. In Australia, I could say Boyd's forest dragon, but I live here in the north woods of Wisconsin, so I say pine, spruce, cedar, hemlock, loon, winter wren, blackburnian warbler, gray wolf, moose, snowshoe hare, mink frog, brook trout, red-backed salamander, spring azure butterfly, Labrador tea, cranberry, dragon's mouth orchid. I'm trying at this particular moment to say white-throated sparrow, white-throated sparrow, white-throated sparrow. I'm talking about this white-throated sparrow, the one singing from the river edge as the night succumbs to gray dawn. I want to talk with birds. I mean talk. I want to know everything. And right now I want to know why this white-throated sparrow sings with such silver clarity while the alder flycatcher has so plainly little to say. And how is it that its song says north, that when I hear the white throat, oh sweet Canada, 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 I see the crimson pink flower of bog laurel, smell sphagnum moss, feel the soft threads of cotton grass between my fingers. To speak of this tiny bird, as Rilke asks of me, I must hear its otherness. I must know how to sing in celebration of a long night gone by. I must know how to grace the wind with an ecstatic simplicity that says, white-throated sparrow. I kneel in prayer. I dance. Dancing with the dead, dancing with the living, dancing with the dying. The light and shadow are in the trees, on the water, among the rocks. So, that's a real downer. Lastly, because I'm probably running out of time and keeping here too long. What's the spirit of this place? Ashland, Wisconsin, Bayfield, Washburn, wherever you may be in this region, in our case, Manitowish. What are the keynotes of these places that you feel spiritually connected to? So what, for instance, do you await about spring? What are the keynotes of spring for you? And I think for us, the first trailing of arbutus that's blooming in the pines along Frog Lake, we go back to try to find that particular little patch of trailing arbutus. The first red-winged blackbirds that return to the marsh right by our house. The first winter wrens singing. Love winter wrens. The first ice off and the first paddle, of course. So I wanted to conclude with another poem yet about spring peepers, because that's... Isn't that great? You know, that first foggy night. Well, last night would have qualified. Is spring peepers calling up here yet?
Yeah.
No. Not yet. Okay. So usually it's a 39-degree night. It's foggier and all get out, and suddenly you start hearing a little beep, beep, beep going on, and pretty soon it's a choir that just rocks your ears, right? And pretty soon you're almost like, stop. You know, it's just so great. So think about that, because I'm going to ask you what the spirit of this place is for you. If we have an extra 5 minutes, we can tolerate me doing that. But I want to read you a poem called Pandemonium. The frogs are chorusing tonight. The peepers chime like 10,000 sleigh bells rung by ecstatic Salvation Army volunteers. Meanwhile, the toads trill at diverging pitches, harmonizing in drones like a hall of chanting Buddhists. All night they sing. Whenever I wake up, they're still there in the dark and the damp under the moon and stars, stage lighting their Dionysian debauch. I tried to sneak up on them to witness the passion that has brought them and their thousands of generations before to these ephemeral ponds. But even in their single-mindedness, they always hear me and they go stone quiet. If I wait long enough, one will give in to his need for a mate and begin singing again. Then the choral dam breaks and the din commences because it must. It's a game of Russian roulette, this fertilizing of eggs. The bet is that the pools won't dry up before the great metamorphosis, from fins to legs, from gills to lungs, from water to forest. All this. Then, without apparent discussion, they agree to gather here again next spring, when a south wind will warm air and water, triggering their tumultuous voices like 1,000 drunken guests at a lavish wedding party, breathing rapture in the dark spring night. So, what's the spirit of this place for any of you, if we could take a few minutes? What speaks to you about this place, touches your spirit? Yes?
The sun beams or the moon beams on the water.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you.
What did she say?
Oh, she said the sun beams or the moon beams shining on the water. Gorgeous. Yes?
It may seem strange, but for me, mud. Every April, the red clay comes alive and it's mud.
And sucks you down. Yeah. Hopefully you keep your boots on when they're sucking on you off your clay. Yeah.
I remember very shortly after our son was born, my parents visited, born in the middle of winter, and in the middle of winter you can't see the roads. They're covered in snow, and my mom asked me, why do you want to raise your kid where there are no roads? And I know exactly why I stayed here when I first came up here. We grew up, when I was growing up, we visited a lot in southern Sweden, and the smell here, and the way the sky looks, and the way the forests look, are exactly what I remember from my childhood from southern Sweden. And I can imagine why a lot of Swedes and Norwegians and a couple stray Danes ended up here.
Lost Danes.
I know exactly why I want to be here, where there are roads.
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you. Anybody else? Come on now, y'all are here for this reason. Jeez.
I came from St. Paul, Minneapolis, born and raised. Millions of people, and I'd find pockets of nature and appreciation for birds that we'd see, and at first raise the binoculars, and later maybe not as much, but still as much for me. What I appreciate about this place is, as you said, no one came here to get rich. Most people are here because of the appreciation of the land and the nature. Kathy and I have been here for a year, and what we're playing with these days is what I see with everyone here. The novelty of being here is fading. We've seen those birds before, but our appreciation of all these things is increasing. And that's what I see in people here that I didn't see as much in the cities. Of course, they had a lot of noise going on. That's what we appreciate about this place.
Yeah, and that's what makes long-term relationships stay together, is you keep appreciating, go back to it again and again, and see more and more and more. And that's how marriages stay together, of places and of couples of people. Yes?
So water, I think, is a big theme up here, and the sound of water also, whether it's the lapping on the shore or a stream, or even in the wintertime, as spring is you can sometimes hear the pounding underneath the ice of the water. It sounds like a drum, and it's one of the most amazing sounds. Very
ancient. Yeah. Or the sounds of ice compressing and all that incredible thunder that they can make. Yeah, crazy. Yeah. Yes?
Hi, my name is Gretchen Spickerman. I'm mother to Amir Kishuba, and we used to live down by John and Mary.
Yes.
And I know all those wonderful sounds of spring and sense of place. We're just learning about it here tonight. Glad to be here.
Gretchen used to raise sheep. She's a fine weaver, if you want to know about. Not sheep, goats. Goats, sorry.
And sheep.
And sheep? I thought there were sheep. Did you raise sheep? Yeah? Yeah. Honor says you did, so that's good enough. Anyway, thank you. Good to see you guys. Anybody else? I know we should quit soon, so I apologize. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say what Marilyn referred to as water. For spring, the spring for me is the first sound of the gurgling of the creek right outside of the
room. Yeah, yeah. Look forward to it. Wait then, yes.
I came camping up here in 1974 or 75, and I recognized heaven is here.
Just that simple, yeah.
Heaven is here.
Heaven is here. Yes, sir.
One of the things that I appreciate most about this place that requires you to turn off your screens and your distractions is the sound and the smell of snow falling in the winter.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes?
Part of it for me is that green that's coming soon. Brand new, brilliant. I can't even describe that color of the green that comes on the trees.
There's so many shades.
After those just bare branches. It's heavenly.
And it is coming.
It is coming.
Although it's supposed to snow
this
cats and dogs.
We have to just keep repeating that.
It's coming. We are resilient people. We're patient sometimes. Cabin fever is hitting heavily. Maybe one more and then I should get off.
Yeah. Well, it is just that word, John, resilience, the ability to find hope. When things are bad to the land in a flood or in a storm, or there's always resilience. There's always something new that will grow out of it. It's the resilience and hope of this place.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much.